And we're back here on Unusual Sources, 93.3 CFMU FM. We should have on the line with us our guest, Stephen Gallins from Ottawa. Stephen, can you hear me?
I can.
Oh, good. Glad it worked the first time. It's good to have you here with us. You know, I'm just saying to our audience, this is, of course, Stephen Gallins. He's Ottawa-based author and activist. He also, he runs the blog, which is What's Left, and that syndicates articles elsewhere. The reason we're speaking with Stephen today is because he wrote a very timely article, I think, and this is about the nuclear posture review that the U.S. government has just come out with. This nuclear posture review is basically a document that sets out how the United States is going to deploy nuclear weapons in a conflict, or should such a conflict arise. Stephen, it's my understanding that this new document mostly says that the U.S. is committed towards using overwhelming conventional, that is, non-nuclear force, but that they have several loopholes. They leave some loopholes that allow them to use nuclear weapons. Can you tell us a little bit about this particular policy?
Yeah. What I find interesting about the new nuclear posture review is it's hailed as kind of a departure from the previous ones, especially that of the Bush administration, which reserved the right of the United States to attack non-nuclear states with nuclear weapons. And this particular nuclear posture review says that the United States will no longer attack non-nuclear states with nuclear weapons, or that's what it seems to say, but it leaves a number of loopholes or escape hatches that the United States can use to indeed attack non-nuclear states with nuclear weapons.
Yes, I think the two major loopholes that we're dealing with here are, number one, if a country is not part of the non-proliferation treaty, then the U.S. entitles itself to attack with nuclear weapons. And the other one is if that country is maybe part of the non-proliferation treaty, but they're in non-compliance with it, so they're apparently not obeying it, then in that case it would also be acceptable for the United States to use nuclear weapons.
Right. Which is kind of interesting. I mean, both of these kind of violate the principle of not attacking non-nuclear states. You could have opted out of the non-proliferation treaty. If you do so, it probably means that you want to develop, well, it does mean that you want to develop nuclear weapons. But you could be in a situation where you haven't actually developed nuclear warheads. For example, North Korea opted out of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty many years ago, in the early 90s, when the United States Strategic Command announced that it was going to be retargeting some of its strategic nuclear weapons on North Korea. At that point, North Korea decided that it would withdraw from the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty and develop its own nuclear deterrent to a U.S. nuclear attack. But today, I mean, it's not really clear whether North Korea has a workable crude nuclear device or not. We know that there's been some testing, but it's never been clear whether the tests were successful. So the United States is saying, well, North Korea has opted out of the non-proliferation treaty, therefore it's a fair target for a nuclear attack by the United States, even though it may not have a nuclear weapon, and even though it doesn't really have the means of delivering a nuclear warhead, at least as far as the United States.
Well, in the case of North Korea, it's my understanding they were in some kind of agreement or treaty with the United States where they were going to do certain things the U.S. wanted, and in return the U.S. would supply them with nuclear fuel or some of the things they needed for the nuclear program. But I don't think the U.S. was keeping their end of the bargain. What happened with that original agreement they had?
Right. So the United States said to North Korea, what we'd like you to do is shut down your plutonium reactor that you're using to develop nuclear fuel for a nuclear device or nuclear arms. And North Korea said, well, we also use the reactor to generate energy, so what are we going to do if we shut it down? And an agreement was reached that the United States and some other countries would build light water reactors, which were considered proliferation resistant. And while they were being built, the United States would provide fuel oil to tide over North Korea's energy requirements. Well, the U.S. government decided that it could tarry on building the nuclear reactors because it believes, as it almost always believes, that the North Korean regime is about to collapse. So why build the reactors when we probably won't have to make good on our commitment? And as the date drew near where the reactors are to be built, the United States government, under the Bush administration, accused the North Korean government of having a secret uranium nuclear enrichment program. And the North Koreans said, we never admitted any such thing. But the U.S. government said, oh, yes, you did. And because of that, we're going to unilaterally cancel this agreement we've had with you. And once the United States did that, this was at about the same time that the United States and Britain had invaded Iraq on entirely spurious grounds. And one Bush administration official warned the North Koreans to draw the appropriate lesson from Iraq, and they did. And they did, and the way they did was by firing up their plutonium reactor and working on the development of a nuclear device.
Yeah, I guess they got the lesson. I guess the lesson was develop nuclear weapons.
Yes, exactly.
Or at least pretend to, or you know, get America scared that you might have that capability. But what does this capability represent? Okay, I think we've touched on this before. If North Korea is able to construct and detonate a nuclear weapon, you know, is that an existential threat to the United States? No, we know it's not. This is what has been called, and you mentioned Edward S. Herman, this is the threat of effective self-defense. If North Korea had a nuclear weapon, it would be a capability that Iraq did not have.
Absolutely. And Iraq, under the sanctions regime, dismantled its weapons of mass destruction and was effectively disarmed, at which point the U.S. and Britain decided it was safe to invade.
No, it's not a big motivation for taking apart a nuclear program of any sort. You know, if that is going to leave you in that situation. And I think you've suggested that, in fact, the United States, as a result of all this, is the largest cause of nuclear proliferation in the world.
Yeah, absolutely, because, I mean, one of the principles of non-proliferation is that nuclear states should not threaten non-nuclear states. And if you threaten non-nuclear states, then what you do is you provide an incentive for them to develop nuclear weapons. And the United States is in the habit of threatening all kinds of weak countries and providing them with an incentive to develop a nuclear deterrent.
Yes, and what you said about North Korea reminded me somewhat of what I had read about Iran. I think it was back in February. You know, the United States, European Union, Russia, China, and Iran had all been involved in these mixed negotiations over Iran's nuclear program. And someone had suggested, it might have been the U.S., it might have been the EU, but that, you know, that an external country provides Iran with certain enriched materials. You know, Iran might even give them the nuclear things and they'd go out of the country and get enriched and come back, and that would help them with their medical isotopes or their, you know, their cyclotrons or whatever. And that was going to help their program, and it would have taken material from outside, you know, which would have increased Iran's dependence and cooperation with the outside world at the same time as it would further its development of nuclear power and whatnot. But I think the United States was trying to block that, or that, you know, they were kind of sitting on their hands and ignoring that. So it seems to me, do you think that, you know, when it comes to making agreements with Iran or North Korea on nuclear power and nuclear weapons and energy and so forth, is the United States honestly interested in peaceful development or any sort of development, or are they just kind of, you know, hoping to buy time for something?
Are they interested in peaceful development of nuclear
energy, perhaps?
Energy? They are in countries that are under the control and influence of the United States, especially if it means profits for the U.S. nuclear industry, as is the case in India, which is not a member of the Non-Proliferation Treaty and which has an estimated 100 nuclear warheads, and which has now recently done a deal with the United States in which the United States will ship spent nuclear fuel to India. But the United States only seems to be interested in blocking peaceful development of nuclear energy in countries that are not under its influence or control, such as Iran.
Well, yeah, you started mentioning North Korea, and then I brought up Iran, and in fact, I mean, these are the two countries at which this new nuclear policy or this new nuclear posture review is mostly directed against. Hillary Clinton specifically mentioned Iran and North Korea. She singled them out in her discussion of this treaty. And also Gates, Secretary of Defense Gates, in this new nuclear posture review made similar statements. He said, "The United States has made an exception in the case of North Korea and Iran because they're not in compliance with the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, All options are on the table." So they've singled out and made a special case for Iran and North Korea. And remember, these are the two remaining members of the so-called Axis of Evil. So we thought it was all over, you know, when Bush set up the Axis of Evil and said there's Iraq, Iran, and North Korea, and then he toppled Iraq, and it turned out to be a disaster and illegal, and everyone was sad about it, and then we thought that it was over. There was no more Axis of Evil. But here it's back. Hillary Clinton's talking about North Korea and Iran and weapons of mass destruction and the Secretary of Defense is, and these are the two countries that are singled out in this nuclear posture review. So are we still on the Axis of Evil?
Yes, I mean, there still is the so-called Axis of Evil. I mean, North Korea and Iran are the countries that remain. It's interesting you said that Hillary Clinton and Gates mentioned them. Not only did they single them out, but North Korea and Iran are singled out in the document itself. It's almost like the Iran-North Korea document. And what also makes it interesting is it starts by talking about, well, you know, we won't threaten with nuclear weapons any country that is a non-nuclear state, but we reserve the right to use nuclear weapons against nuclear states. But they don't talk about India, which is a nuclear state, which is not a part of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, or Pakistan, or Israel, a nuclear state, not part of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Instead, they talk about Iran, which is a part of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, and doesn't, according to its own, or the United States' own intelligence community, have nuclear weapons, and they talk about North Korea. And so, as you point out, I mean, why Iran and North Korea? I mean, these are the two countries that remain on the U.S.-designated Axis of Evil. Mr. Obama puts together a nuclear posture review that looks like it's different from that of the Bush administration. But when you read it, you discover it's not different at all. And Obama also apparently doesn't recognize the Axis of Evil. And while he may not use those words, it's certainly clear that U.S. foreign policy is seized of the problem of overturning the regimes in those two countries.
Well, I guess in that case, you know, we're talking about continuity of U.S. policy from Bush to Obama. The empire is still there in a sense. And that's what comes to the, I guess, the big question or the big problem here. And that's why is it that the United States can go up to North Korea and tell them this is how you're going to negotiate your nuclear program, this is how you're going to build a reactor or close down a reactor, and they can go to Iran and they can say the whole world is waiting on you, Iran, to do this and to do that and to work in compliance with us. And they get to single out which countries are picked on, and they get to push agreements and create a need or a sense that there's an urgent need for further curtailments of various things. So the United States is coming up and directing how these programs should unfold. And you made an allusion to the old empires, new and old, emerging and dying from the post-World War I period, because after World War I, the world powers tried to make this agreement to renounce war, that they weren't going to kill each other en masse anymore to resolve problems. But the U.S. reserved rights to action and its sphere of influence, you know, the whole Monroe Doctrine thing. And Britain, in this agreement, they weren't just content with the defense of empire. So Britain reserved for itself full freedom of action in any unspecified regions of the world. So, you know, as you said, it owned a quarter of the world already, and it reserved for itself freedom of action in any unspecified regions of the world. What you're saying, I guess, is that there's not much difference between Britain reserving unspecified regions of the world and the United States setting out a policy on who gets to develop weapons and who's going to be targeted and so forth.
Right. And the reason I made the reference to that is the guy who I referred to was R. Palm Dutt, who mentioned this Kellogg Pact, which is a pact to, as you said, to renounce the use of force in foreign policy. And he showed all of the exceptions that the great powers made. They said, oh, yeah, we agree. We're never going to use force or military or aggression to resolve these problems, except, and then they had a whole bunch of reservations or escape clauses. And he said at the end of that, you know, with these small exceptions, the imperialist signatories renounced war. And it struck me that the Nuclear Posture Review was in exactly the same vein. Because it begins by saying, okay, we're not going to attack non-nuclear states with nuclear weapons. That's not a good idea. But hold on. Here are all of these exceptions to our policy. We are going to attack North Korea if we want. We would attack Iran if we want because even though it has no nuclear weapons and it's a member of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, because we don't think that it's abiding by the Non-Proliferation Treaty. And also something that we haven't mentioned is that the Nuclear Posture Review says we won't even attack countries that attack us with biological or chemical weapons. We won't attack them with nuclear weapons, but we'll use overwhelming conventional force. And then a little later on they say, except if it's in our interest to do so, which is the greatest escape clause of all. So we won't do this unless we do this. And it struck me that that was exactly like what the great powers did with the Kellogg Pact. They said, oh, yeah, we agree that we're going to pursue a peaceful foreign policy, except when it's in our interest not to.
Right. They're going to follow the rules, except, you know, when it doesn't suit them. Well, there's one other thing I would add to what you said about that. In fact, Clinton made a statement that I think is more frightening than you're maybe giving credence to, because she said, if we can prove that a biological attack originated in a country that attacked us, then all bets are off. So it's just like what you said, I guess, but she's saying that we leave ourselves a lot of room for contingencies. So
right.
if there is a biological attack and the United States seems to think it comes from a certain country, then somebody could get nuked. And you know, that's a bit frightening. I mean, we all know how reliable the U.S. intelligence is, you know, on the Iraq, on the weapons of mass destruction, on the Taliban in Afghanistan, on Osama bin Laden's whereabouts, you know, what's happening in Pakistan, who they're shooting at in Iraq. I mean, you know, they know very little on a lot, and yet they would reserve the right to attack a country or a state or, you know, millions of people with nuclear weapons if they thought that someone had attacked them with biological weapons from a certain country.
What I found interesting about Clinton's remark was that it was at odds with what was in the Nuclear Posture Review. But, I mean, you're right. And how do we know that this decision about whether or this determination that the attack originated in a particular country is actually legitimate, or it's simply not more of the, you know, the kind of Bush administration? Well, we have evidence that there are weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Or the Clinton administration's, well, we have evidence that there's a genocide going on in Kosovo.
Yes, very much so. The United States loves to create rationales, loves to create justifications, and it's worthwhile to look at every single one they've ever used, whether it was the Panama, what they said about Noriega, Yugoslavia, saying there was a genocide, Iraq with the weapons of mass destruction, among various other. You know, I should mention, I read a very interesting a CIA document came out. It was it on WikiLeaks? I don't remember which site it was on, but, you know, there's this declassified CIA document, and it said, you know, we need to find more ways to get support for the war in Afghanistan, and one of the problems is, like 80% of people in Germany and some other European countries are against the war. So there is a danger that governments would listen to their electorate and withdraw the troops from Afghanistan. That was, you know, that was seen as a danger. How do we sell this war? And they said, we need to play up the women's rights angle more. There's sympathy for women's issues, and we need to exploit that sympathy by linking the war to the promotion of women's rights in Afghanistan. So they've consciously recognize that, you know, out of people's humanitarian concerns, they have a wedge through which they can try to drive some people into supporting the war on Afghanistan. So they'll use any justification. They're looking for, you know, people's weaknesses, their moral beliefs, whatever they can to create a push for war, even in Afghanistan, just to stay in there, to continue occupying it with troops. That they've pulled out the women's rights card once again. So I think you're right on that issue.
Well, they're good marketers, and there's no better marketer than Obama. I mean, he is unparalleled in his excellence as a marketer. far better than Bush, and therefore far more dangerous than Bush.
Well, Obama is much more popular than Bush was in Europe. I think, number one, Americans don't feel embarrassed because they have someone who can, you know, speak the English language or pronounce nuclear properly. And the other is that, you know, Europeans think that something really good has happened with the election of Obama. And there were positive attributes attached to his election, but people are missing the forest for the tree, I guess, in this case. You know, so it's a facelift for the empire, as many have said. And I think it was Ralph Nader who said that from Bush to Obama, there's been a seamless transition on the war. So while some domestic policies may have changed and the style or the mood of things may have changed, when it comes to war planning, the Bush agenda is still fully in play. All of the policies they want are still going ahead, the expansion of the wars into Pakistan and elsewhere. So I think you're right. And when it comes to foreign policy, when it comes to the empire, all the candidates from Bush to Obama to anyone else who's running, Clinton, they all have to say, long live the empire or you're not going to get elected.
Mm-hmm. And was the Bush agenda anything other than the logical extension of the Clinton agenda?
That's something people don't like to talk about. I mean, the only reason they could attack Iraq so successfully, so quickly, so easily, they viewed it as low-hanging fruit. Who was it that said that? Was it Richard Perle? I don't remember, but one of the Bush advisors said, you know, we got to go after the low-hanging fruit, the easier countries first. So Iraq was easy, and it was easier because of Clinton. The Clinton administration sanctions, which killed a million or a million and a half people, including half a million children, as we all know from Albright's comment, that was the Clinton administration. You know, we all remember the 90s and Starbucks and Seattle, and it wasn't that so great, but Clinton was bombing Iraq. They had air overflights. They had no-fly zones. They had the sanctions that restricted even pencils and food from coming into the country. So there was 10 years or so of these devastating sanctions after the first Gulf War from Bush number one. So you have continuity from Bush one, Clinton, Bush two, and now Obama, who is has left tens of thousands of troops in Iraq. Yeah, you have continuity. You can trace it back from very far-reaching policies by the United States. It seems the State Department, they don't change. You know, they're not elected, I guess, and they get to stay and come in and out of government. Like people like Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney, they were kind of, you know, during the Reagan administration, they might have been part of the governing body, and then they go back into the State Department and the defense networks, and then they come back. So, yeah, you've got, that's your good old military-industrial complex coming back. So, yeah, I think continuity of policy goes from Obama back to Bush, back through to Clinton, Bush 1, and so forth. So, yeah, I think it's important for people to remember that because, you know, we talk about Obama and what Obama's doing and what the First Lady is wearing and Michelle Obama's arms and whatnot. But, of course, we don't want to lose sight of the most important issue, which is that these policies are continuing. And as much as we might laugh that Bush is gone and his embarrassments to America have ended, I think Bush is laughing and his people are laughing because their agenda continues.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you also mentioned low-hanging fruit, which is significant because then you could ask, well, why was Iraq low-hanging fruit? I mean, it was low-hanging fruit because it had been effectively disarmed and made into a military foe that was certainly not competent or formidable. Whereas North Korea, well, the United States, if it wished to, could easily devastate North Korea. It still does not represent low-hanging fruit in the sense that Iraq was.
And that's the crux of your article, isn't it? Because Bush got rid of the low-hanging fruit. He got Iraq, you know, through his flimsy justifications and his overwhelming conventional force. Remember shock and awe? You know, overwhelming conventional force. That shock and awe policy is kind of carrying out today. But when it comes to the countries like Iran or North Korea, which might be harder targets, you need a stronger campaign to go after them. You need a government with more legitimacy in the United States. And I think, you know, maybe Obama is the person you need if you want to go after Iran, because there was a lot of backlash against the Iraq war. And if you watch The Daily Show or Mad TV, there are skits making fun of the Iraq war and how Bush wanted to go into Iran. People understood that Bush and Cheney, they wanted to go into Iran after Iraq. And there was a lot of dissatisfaction over that idea. But now that Obama's in and they've sort of wiped away a lot of the stink of the Bush administration in terms of publicity, now, you know, maybe Obama's the person who they could count on to go into Iran.
No, absolutely. I mean, it's left-leaning or apparently left-leaning governments that are always have the greater success in selling these kinds of aggressions.
Right. Well, you're talking about the Democrats here. They don't like to feel spineless, and they've been known to take on some of the more aggressive wars. So you can't assume that just because Obama is in office and because people call him a liberal and a socialist and whatnot, that you're not going to get policies that might, you know, make Bush look small by comparison. We'll see. And hopefully people can get their act together in terms of the peace movement, in terms of the real international community, which is, you know, two-thirds of the world or three-quarters of the world, and put a stop to further sanctions and threats and whatnot, war games, provocative exercises against Iran, because it's not going to be a good scenario for anyone. So we'll be covering that issue. We'll be watching it closely to see how it unfolds. Stephen, I wanted to thank you very much for being with us. And let me see, how can people find your blog? It's What's Left, right?
That's right.
So they can just Google What's Left, or what is the direct web address?
www.gowans.wordpress.com.
Okay, so gowans.wordpress.com.
Right.
Okay, well, thanks very much, and thanks for writing that article. You're one of the first people to put any sort of substantive commentary on this new nuclear posture review, and I think you understood its significance, so I'm glad you did that, and I thank you for doing that. And again, thanks very much for being on our program this week.
Okay, thanks for having me.
Thanks.
Bye.
Bye-bye.